some reason I can't hear it, so I'm going to...
This is the Beat Your Jeans podcast. My name is Nate G.
We'll just
I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hoff, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org.
Hold on, I got Jen.
All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk. We're having some trouble, so we're going to try to troubleshoot this live on air. So bear with us, and then we'll get things up and running. All right. So,
are we all here?
Dr. Lyle, are you? Jen,
can you hear me at all?
Dr. Lyle? Yeah, we can hear Dr. Lyle.
Can you hear?
Good. Yeah. Jen, can you hear Dr. Lyle?
Yep, I can hear you both. You can hear me?
Oh, what?
Okay.
What a miracle.
Okay, good.
Wow, weird. Weird. We literally just got this together in the last 5 seconds, people. So this is very exciting. Mercury must be retrograde. That's the only explanation.
So the only thing left is for the good quality audio, Dr. Lyle, we got to get you on the double ender, the TriCast. So
okay, can you walk me through that?
Yeah, so if you go to your email address.
I did that already, so I'm all booted up on it.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah,
I tried it too, Nathan.
Episode 206?
Yeah, I followed the link, but there's no signs of life there.
Yeah. There isn't. Okay, so it looks like I'm on.
Okay, we're out of luck.
Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. No, because it's important because the audio is really terrible because of Blog Talk Radio without it. So I'm going to email you guys again. Just a little dig at Blog Talk Radio because of all the issues they're having. So I'm going to email you right now, Dr. Lyle.
Okay.
And
I'm
with the link.
Close this
and let's
link.
See if that works.
Okay, we'll close it
close
again.
The window completely. Yeah.
Okay, let me see if there's another Google Voice. Okay. All right, and I will go to my mail again, and we will see. Here we go. And we'll give it a shot. Okay, it asked me, and I put in, what have I put in for guests?
Just put in, it doesn't matter what you put in. It doesn't matter what you put in, just put Doug.
Okay.
Yeah. Gurus is probably another
guy. Yeah, guru. That's pretty sure. Okay.
Legend in his own mind.
Not Jen is
put
also
in,
acceptable.
All right, I put that in, and sort of nothing seems to be happening. Showing my voice, you know. So nothing's happening. It's not working.
All right, so bear with me for like 5 more minutes, maybe less.
Sure.
I'm going to send another link. So sometimes these things, just for our listeners, welcome to the life of podcasting. Let's do this here.
Worst case scenario, we just have crappy audio for this episode. So we'll be sure to say really important things that no one can understand. That's just how it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, I think it's relatively straightforward to try this again. So I think...
Okay.
I feel like we shouldn't just give up that quickly. Okay. So, Dr. Lyle, I'm going to send you another link.
Okay.
Okay. Let's do another link. Okay. Now let's try that. Let's see if that works.
I'm waiting for the email.
Okay. Let's see if those electronics are faster.
Where else can you go for this kind of content, people? This is just like top notch.
Yeah.
Groundbreaking.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, so when this type of thing happens, what I do is I cut off the internet for everybody staying here at the Fasting Escape, but they don't know it. So in case they're listening live, that's why their internet's being cut off.
Oh,
to try to squeeze every bit of juice. Yeah.
That's awesome. Very, very good.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Here it is. Right. Here it comes. Okay. I can type anything. So I'll type Doug. And now about now. Can you hear me now? Through there? It looks
we can hear you, yeah. It looks like it's alive, yet I'm not
it
there.
It looks like it's alive on the cast,
anywhere.
But...
Does it show that Nate's also signed in there, Doug, or is it just you?
No, it doesn't show you or Nathan on the cast.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to.
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate, because I was hoping to clip some audio from this one. Huh.
I'll raise my
hand.
Can
he do quick time as well?
Oh, yeah. Let's do this. God, this is fun. Okay. Let me try to follow the link I sent you. Okay. Try this. Well... Yeah, I don't see you there either, Doug. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's try one final thing, and let's try one final thing, and then I'm prepared to. You guys okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Last shot.
Okay. Last shot. Okay. Okay. Send you one more email. So this is the email titled, "Click This One." Mr. Guru, Dr. Guru.
Dr. Guru to you.
Dr. Guru. That's it. That's one of my favorite all-time lines for The Big Short. Dr. Michael.
It's so great. It's the best moment in the whole movie.
Oh, God. In a movie full of great moments.
It is.
Just the apex. Just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's check your email again and see if that's working now.
Okay, I'm waiting for email.
Let's hit refresh, and then it should be coming in.
Set you free.
Okay. Here we go.
You can always.
All right.
Yeah,
I'm gonna click the link now. Are you ready? Here we
all
go.
All right. Jen, can you say a little rain dance or prayer or cross your fingers or something?
Sure. I can appeal all to right. the divine forces beyond our comprehension. as the resident sorcerer.
I'm here,
my
but.
Job.
Okay, I did my thing. Nothing happening.
Okay,
we're out of luck, Nathan. We just gotta do the best we can with what we have.
All right. Well. Okay. Well.
You don't go to war with the All podcast right. you want. You go to war with the podcast you have.
That's it.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
All right.
Well, okay. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, painstakingly making it through the podcast this evening. We are here with episode 206, and the questions today are about depression. We've got a question about why does a girlfriend ignore when mad? And then we've got a question about a 25-year relationship with some issues. So Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, let's take it away. You guys ready?
We're ready.
Dive in.
All right, dear doctors, depression often gets talked about as being a biological condition, and that just like having a broken arm, treating depression with medication is similar to treating a broken bone with a splint. What is the opinion of Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk about treating depression with medication versus taking an evolutionary approach to helping individuals improve the esteem dynamics in their life? The combination of medication and therapy is often viewed as the best treatment, but I don't think most therapies take the approach that Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk do.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take this. Yes. So our colleagues in the social sciences have that, and that includes psychiatrists who have wandered into psychology. Actually, apparently, nobody's paying any attention to the notion that this is an evolved organism, and that its nervous system is exquisitely accurate. So, if you go to an ophthalmologist and you say something is really hurting in my eye, they don't say, "Oh, well, that's okay. We've got an anesthetic we can stick in your eye so that you won't feel the pain." They treat the pain in your eye as something very serious, that there's some problem, there's something wrong, okay? That they don't say that the signal of the pain is in error. They look to figure out what's causing the pain. They look at the signal of the pain as a signal of a problem, of a relationship between the organism and its environment. The same thing would be true if you go to the dentist and your tooth hurts. They don't say, "Well, here, take an opiate so that you don't feel the pain." Or you go to an orthopedist and, you know, your knee's in excruciating pain, and they don't say, "Oh, well, here, take a bunch of Percocet or something like this so that you don't feel the pain." That would be insane. We look at the signals that the body sends, that the nervous system has evolved to be unbelievably good at trying to tell you what to do. So if your knee hurts, you don't cover up your ears because you have excruciating pain because of sound coming in your ears. The pain in your knee tells you, be very careful of your knee. There's a problem, and don't work hard on it unless you have to. Same thing if you have a toothache. Yeah, it doesn't hurt in your big toe. So the signals are specified. They do their best to coach the organism into helping avoid further exacerbation of the problem. And the same thing is true with all feelings. So what we've been talking about is the sensations of pain, but we can also now further explain that all feelings are signaling devices to orient the organism as to the relationship between self and environment, good and bad. And in fact, the good and bad, we use those words to describe pleasant and unpleasant feelings that on the good side tell you to continue to do what you're doing or move closer to a stimuli that is resulting in a positive feeling inside yourself. And bad is something that it's causing you to, you know, feel bad, a stimulus that's causing you to get a signal that tells you that your likelihood of survival and reproduction is dropping. So whether that means literally, you know, a rock in your shoe, that the fact that the rock in your shoe is uncomfortable, it seems amazing and absurd almost, the notion that the rock in your shoe and your foot hurting as you step on that rock, that it would be a signal of the reduction of likelihood of your survival and reproductive success, but it is in fact true. So the fact that the rock hurts tells you that it is over evolutionary time, a threat to the tissue integrity of that magnitude was sufficiently worth avoiding, that it was worth signaling the organism and trying to get them to avoid it. So, also, we wouldn't say, for example, you just lost the Super Bowl that you've been, you know, working your whole life to win. So when you go out into the parking lot to go home, you suddenly feel like an immense euphoria and love, for your cousin. Why would that happen? That would never happen. Okay. Your feelings are orderly. The information processing of the mind is following biological law. So the notion that if you are depressed, that there's something wrong with your brain, that the signaling is wrong, and that we have to change the signal, that the signaling system is incorrect. Okay. This is the first assumption is that, oh no, the signaling system's wrong. Really? Is that what the ophthalmologist says when you're going with excruciating eye pain? That is not what they say. So how we got from to this point is really something. It's a matter of spectacular history of commerce and the pharmaceutical industry, et cetera. And this all really began in the 1970s, and it began as a result of as the wars were being fought, the turf battles that were being fought between psychology and psychiatry, and actually medicine fighting, allopathic medicine fighting very, very serious turf wars with everybody, and then winning with major court cases in the 1950s and getting essentially oligopoly type control over medicine. That then leads to the MD becomes the highest status, highest paid profession in the country. The and incomes relative to everybody else rose dramatically after that. The it was always respected, but it became far more lucrative. The in the 1960s and 70s, something interesting started to happen. There was a new profession in the world, a new treating profession, clinical psychology, was starting to come of age. They had begun their lives essentially as testers, people that would give tests, but then they started to do therapy. And that started to threaten psychiatry that was doing sitting on the couch three times a week, psychoanalytic garbage, and that's how they were making a lot of money. But suddenly people started to get the idea that maybe I can talk, three times a week to the psychologist for a third the price, and it seems about as good. And they did. And so psychiatry as a talking therapy profession started losing substantial market share. And pretty soon the psychologists started losing market share to the social workers. So pretty soon. And, the bartenders were always holding down their end of the market. And so this is sort of how things were happening, and they were actually, psychiatry was in a crisis in the 1970s as this was, you started to get major health insurance and you started to get psychologists essentially fighting their way into being able to be insured. And so, and insurance companies all obviously were then facing a problem of paying for any major long-term insurance for psychotherapy. They started to say, hey, we're not going to do this. So it's going to have to be short-term. So psychiatry, as the way it had sort of made its living, was in trouble. And it was a top-down, very aggressive, purposeful move on the part of psychiatry to move into pharmaceuticals. And they knew that that is how that they would be okay. They were at the bottom of the heap in medicine in terms of making a living. I think if we went back and looked at the data, in 1975, they were in trouble. They were making less money than everybody else in their field. Maybe not everybody, but maybe might be true. They were not doing well, and so they got saved by a conscious and deliberate move on the leadership to wed psychiatry to the pharmaceutical industry. And along with that came a great deal of time and attention and effort and marketing and everything else towards the DSM. So the American Psychiatric Association then became the authors of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for psychiatric disorders. And the subtext of this is that there's all these diseases, and these diseases are just like the diseases of, Ebola and everything else. And therefore, we have to have medications for these diseases. And And that's what happened. And so along with this, there has been, you know, certainly this makes some sense to the general public in the same way that if you have a disease and you have a medication that can help that disease, then you take a pill and then it helps it. And so what actually happened, again, not by accident, this is by top-down corporate design, was that the phrase, taking your antidepressants is just like taking insulin for diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a concerted effort
to normalize that.
Yeah, this was absolutely not an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a concerted diabolical plan on the part of pharmaceutical industry and wedded to the psychiatric profession, the American Psychiatric Association. This is all about this paradigm shift away from what they had been was psychodynamic, you know, neo-Freudian therapists. That's what they were, completely outside of the scope of any training in, you know, or in the science of psychology. So they were completely, they were their own rogue people, but because they were smarter than everybody else, then that meant that that was cool. And that's who was allowed to charge big fees and would be expected to get your great treatment from your 3 times a week analysis of your childhood traumas. Okay. So that's what it was. And then it got into trouble because it turns out that psychologists could talk about those things just as well as they could, close enough. And so then what happened was, hey, if we're going to make any big money, we're going to be rolling pills. That's how we're going to do it. And that is exactly what they did. And so psychiatry is now very successful relative to other, what do you call that in medicine when you have these sub professions? Specialties, okay?
Specialties.
So psychiatry is a perfectly very nice, highly respected. They're just like real doctors, and they've got real diseases, and they got real cures for them too. All the way to our questioner here, who asks an incredibly innocent, very direct, honest question to us, and saying, "Hey, how come nobody thinks about it the way you do, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk? How come everybody else says that the best thing to do is, you know, do some talk therapy, but make sure you get your medication because you would need medication, right? I mean, just like insulin for diabetes. It's like a splint for your arm. Well, when you have your arm hurt, what do you feel like doing? Not moving it. Okay. What does your body do? It does what it can do in evolution to immobilize it. That's exactly what's going on. Where do you see depressed people that, you know, Joe, that just his girlfriend broke up with him, as he starts chewing some kind of leaf that has the chemical that's in, you know, there's some serotonin boosting chemical that'll increase his serotonin to stop his depression? No, that's not what happens. He goes and talks to his buddies and then goes down to the river and contemplates suicide. And he thinks about how unattractive he is and the stupid things he said. And he reviews his display is what he does. He's brooding and thinking about what mistakes he made. He's trying to figure out how he can improve his esteem situation. That's what he does. So, no, the mind is not broken, and it doesn't need to be altered chemically any more than the inside of your eye needs to be altered chemically. If you've got something in it, you need an ophthalmologist to actually restore the appropriate relationship between self and environment. If you're depressed, the depression is giving you clues. So, in principle, the first thing that I see when I see a depressed person is I'm looking for the domain in their life where they're in trouble. You know, is it romance? Okay. Is it trade? Is it friendship? You know, is it family? Is it their health? Those are the 5 major domains of human value. Now, in principle, someone could come into me and say, you know, doc, I have great romantic relationship, love my wife, everything's great. I'm attracted to her. She's attracted to me. Sexual dynamics are fine. That's not the problem. Got good friends. We get together once a week with, you know, these 3 other couples. We have a great time. That's not the problem. I'm making a really good living. I'm respected at my work. I enjoy it. I feel fulfilled in terms of my potential and where I'm going in life. That's not the problem. Got two great kids, one boy, one girl. They're both doing well. They're cute. I love them to death. That's not the problem. My health is good. I just got a full checkup. That's not the problem. But I'm miserable.
Yeah, never seen that. Never.
I've never seen it. 30 years of practice.
Yeah, could happen. Never seen it.
It, in principle, it could happen. I'm waiting. Right? Okay, when I start questioning and when Dr. Hawk starts questioning, we know that if there's a
where
problem.
Where does it hurt?
Where does beautifully said. Where does it hurt? And they can
and
tell
it,
you,
it
you start
hurts.
Poking around.
Oh, yeah. And it probably hurts in several places, but it hurts more in one of those places than another place. So that's where you start. And that's all we do. We're not magicians. We're just looking for where the injury is. And other psychologists are not.
Yeah. In other words, even if they are, they're intimidated by the zeitgeist that has now come down from the gods of psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry and has intimidated everybody into thinking that the brain is broken and that there's magic stuff to fix it. So no, the answer isn't, well, make sure you take your medication along with any pathetic little talk therapy that you do. Okay. Because you've got an underlying problem. No, that's not it. And a reading, you know, anybody that's on any psychiatric medication at all, if you're smart enough to read a reasonably, a intermediate level complex book, if you're smart enough to take a college class and get a B in anything, then you're smart enough to read Robert Whitaker's Anatomy of an Epidemic. And if you're on any kind of psychiatric medication, it would behoove you to read that book to be an informed, so that you're making an informed decision about what it is that you're doing to your brain. So, yeah, we do think differently. I think very differently than most of my colleagues do. Most of my colleagues don't really have too strong of opinions in psychology. They're intimidated by psychiatry. They feel like they're second-class citizens. They didn't have good enough grades or weren't smart enough to get into med school. And the psychiatrists can talk circles around them. And those people got A's in organic chemistry. And therefore, we just shrug our shoulders and we're glad to get the overpaid compensation that's more than we deserve for what it is that we do for people, which isn't much. So as a result, you know, the right move on the chessboard is to just – you know, duck your head into your shoulders like a turtle and say, well, maybe you ought to talk to the doc about, you know, getting some Prozac or something like that so they can help you. And then I'll be working with you too. We'll work as a team. Sounds reasonable. It's not. What's reasonable is the correct identification of where does it hurt. And then from there, your nervous system is attempting to inform you very clearly and loudly about where the deficiency is in your execution and performance in the competitive domains of life. And so we need to look at that carefully and figure out what we're going to do differently. And then we're going to make the most reasonable efforts to make those changes so that we can have some success. That's what we do. Okay. And when we have success, we start to have success. Guess what happens? The depression magically goes away. Okay. In fact, something that that's a great joy for Jen Hawk and Rick Seidel, my good friend who's a psychologist back in Virginia, and myself, is that by taking this approach, the times when we are actually able to identify a clear mistake in the person's competitive plan and outline for them how they're going to do things differently. We've all had the experience of the person literally starting to grin in the room, like, got it, I didn't think of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's like, you know, we didn't have to now go through 4 years of therapy. We didn't have to go through 20 weeks of CBT to, quote, change our thinking. We just needed some insight how we were going to do something differently that talked to the source code, and the person says, that'll work.
That's going to work. That's going to do it.
That's going to do it. And that that's we can't say that that's going to be true in every case. Of course not, because a lot every case is different and every person's issues are different and the reason why they're hurting are different. But I've yet to see a person that's hurting because their brain has some biochemical imbalance. Okay, no, that's what's happening is that, you know, if you're suffering from depression, you're suffering from failure feedback cues. And when we get you more successful, the depression goes away, just like it's supposed to. All right.
Dr. Lyle, beautifully, beautifully said. I really appreciate that.
So glad we got it on a really fancy tape there, Nate.
Yeah. Dr. Hawk, can we get a comment from you about all this?
Yeah, well, it's hard to add anything to that sweeping magisterial tour de force of the history of psychology and medication. That's beautiful. I think the only thing that I would throw in there is that it's a, you know, there's a reciprocal dynamic between, you know, there was this sort of, you know, as Dr. Lyle says, a concerted diabolical effort to normalize the medication of mental illness and depression and anxiety in this chemical imbalance model. But there's also on the part of the consumer, there's the energy conservation impulse and the, you know, oh, if there's a magic pill that I can take to feel better and not have to, you know, do the work and go through a process and feel uncomfortable for a while and pay the price of changing whatever it is that I need to change to make myself more competitive and to experience better feedback, because that's very often, you know, depending on the individual, a very intimidating prospect. And this is what drives people into ego traps and you know, motivates them to just avoid the competitive process in all kinds of ways. And one of those ways that is very normalized and very, you know, this is just what you do is that you take a pill because you've got a chemical imbalance. And certain personalities are more prone to taking that road than others. And just like, you know, how many times have you heard someone say something like, oh, if there's a pill to make me thin, I would take it, rather than go to all the effort to change your diet and change your lifestyle and make big changes in your process to meet a goal. So I think this is a two-way relationship. And so we don't want to completely underestimate that, because they're feeding each other for sure. I think I've told the story on the podcast before, but I always remember I was quote unquote depressed because I had been, you know, dumped by the love of my life. And I went in to go see the university psychologist or the university psychiatrist rather, and, you know, little chit chat, and she tries to medicate me. She tries to prescribe me Prozac or whatever it was. And I'm like, no, you know, I'm really not interested. And this was a long time ago and I hadn't read Anatomy of an Epidemic yet, but I'd read enough and I was wary enough that I knew that I didn't want to go down that road. And she pushed and she pushed and I refused and I refused. And finally I left and I was checking out at the desk and she literally ran out into the waiting room and said, you know, in front of everybody that was out there, are you sure I can't write you a prescription for something? Like this amazing, like could not comprehend that I wouldn't take that shortcut and that I would be willing to just go suffer for a while and experience the failure feedback and move through it and allow it to organically change my behavior just like it's supposed to. So this is how these relationships evolve and why this is so incentivized on both sides of the equation. So it's a total mess.
God, beautiful.
Fascinating.
I always forget about that.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you guys for the answer. It's wonderful because I know just in my life, like looking back, my grandmother was always minded towards don't take the drugs, don't take the pills. There's just something about her explanations was just like, telling us don't, you know, there's something about the drugs, and she didn't have a eloquent explanation like both of you did, but it was just something in the genes potentially that that we just didn't want to do that. But I remember, you know, feeling bad getting rejected, whether through jobs or mates or whatever it is, or friends, and those seemed to be the best parts of my life because that seemed to motivate me to improve a particular set of circumstances. So, you know, looking back, it wasn't a bad thing. It was actually the thing that the big driver of improvement.
Sure. Yeah. This
no
is so,
question.
So much of this comes down to personality, though. I mean, we really can't underestimate that. Like, you know, your grandmother has this inherent wariness of it. And my grandmother was absolutely fly in the flag for better living through chemistry. You know, if there was a pill that she could take to feel better quicker and to avoid, you know, struggle and suffering, she was first in line. And she just had that kind of personality. She was a little impulsive, darling human. And I just absolutely adored her, but absolutely wired to take the shortcut, avoid the pain, avoid the competition. And so there's a lot of variation among people in sort of just how predisposed they are to be responsive to a suggestion like that. And obviously, as we've seen, there's a very substantial market for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fabulous.
That's wonderful.
All good.
So for listeners listening, if you are feeling a little bit of hurt or, you know, have some questions, I guess you can contact Dr. Lyle or Dr. Hawk on esteemdynamics.com. So just go there and have a phone consult with Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle. Okay, so our next question. Mm-hmm. Dear doctors, I'm a male, and I've noticed that in numerous relationships, if my girlfriend was mad at me, then she would just flat out ignore me. I don't understand this behavior, as anger would usually lead me to talk through issues and maybe try to resolve them, whereas the girlfriends just ignore my calls and messages, sometimes days at a time. This has caused me tremendous stress to the point of getting no sleep and significantly impairing my life functioning. How do I deal with this type of situation, and is this a male-female difference in conflict resolution, or is it an esteem dynamic where I'm actually over-rewarded?
Hmm. Yeah, well, I can tackle this one first. It probably won't be nearly as comprehensive as the last answer that Dr. Lyle gave. But I have been the ignoring girlfriend when I've been upset, because that's very congruent with my personality. So I feel like I've got some special insight into this one. So the overarching idea here is that, you know, all communication is some kind of manipulation. You're not going to any kind of effort to communicate anything, no matter how you're communicating it, unless you're making there's an estimated benefit that your circumstances will improve your statistical likelihood of gene survival after you execute that communication. But that estimate of your improvement to your circumstances is always being filtered through your personality. So, you know, I'm always just beating this personality drum, because I just really want people to get it in their heads that this is where you start. Like, you can't understand anything until you understand the variation of human personality and how profound it is and how much it is affecting how you're seeing the world and how you're behaving in the world. So different people can face the same situation and be upset for the same reasons, but they're going to communicate differently, because they're manipulating the situation to get what they want and to improve their circumstances differently, because they're filtering it through their personality. So, you know, this question makes me think of my two dogs. So my two dogs can want exactly the same thing, can be subject to exactly the same dynamic. They both want to go outside, for example. But the one that's more disagreeable is pushy and bossy, and she's going to go over to the door and sort of swat at it and stare at me and make a nuisance of herself. And the sweet one is going to come up, and he's going to gently bop me with his nose, and he might just sit there and look at me and chirp a little bit. Like, it's a different strategy. They're asking for the same thing, but they're coming at it through their innate personality traits. And the sweet one can escalate. You know, if I ignore him long enough and I start to push his threshold of what's unfair, he will hit a point where he starts to get pushier, just like she's starting off there. So if you've got a girlfriend who's upset with you and she's avoiding you or stonewalling you, or she's avoiding competition for some reason, This doesn't have anything to do with the fact that she's a female. There's no inherent difference there, other than women being a little more agreeable on average than males. And so they're a little less prone to overt conflict, at least at the same threshold. But more likely what's going on is that you are on the more disagreeable side, and you are winding up in relationships with women who are on the more agreeable side, and they are less seeking of overt conflict. And so the way that they are trying to manipulate the situation, i.e. communicate with you, is through avoidance, what we would call passive aggressiveness, and anything short of a big screaming fight. That's just not in everybody's nature. It's certainly, you know, people can be pushed to it if they're perceiving the situation as sufficiently unfair. Even the most agreeable person can eventually be escalated to a point where they get there. But people get there at different rates according to what their baseline personality characteristics are like. So that's most likely what's going on. She, you know, and there's also the dynamic estimate of not just how she's communicating naturally because of her general personality traits, but how she's communicating dynamically with you because of how she estimates your response to her anger or her discontent or whatever it is. So, you know, you say you're kind of keeping yourself up, you're not getting any sleep, it's impairing your life functioning. You know, there's a couple of cues in this question that you might be a little on the disagreeable side and possibly a little on the emotionally unstable side. And I can tell you from my perspective, when I have been in relationships with people who have those personality characteristics, I'm much more likely to retreat into something that would look like the behavior you're explaining because I'm anticipating sort of an unstable response or a volatile response from the other party relative to what I would feel comfortable with. So it's better to retreat, better to ghost, better to be passive aggressive rather than get into some kind of situation where I'm going to feel insecure, or unsafe, or just unsure of getting what it is that I want to improve my circumstances of gene survival. So I think that's likely what's going on. She may just be, she may be defecting, and these are the ways that she's cueing you that she's defecting. She wants out of the relationship. She doesn't want to have a big fight about it and break up. So she's sort of pushing you to do that. And if she is over-rewarded or if you're over-rewarded, she's probably not particularly motivated to talk it out with you anyway. So all of those different components could be happening. We'd have to know more about the specifics of the relationship, but I think fundamentally this question comes down to personality and strategies related to personality to get what you want in life.
Wow, this makes a lot
good.
Of sense.
Yeah.
Dr. Lyle, do you have anything to add?
No, that was just as comprehensive as my answer was in the previous one.
In half the time.
Oh man, these are gems. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, I wish the audio was even better, but I'll do my best to try to clip these.
Oh no.
All
right.
Crank it up a little bit.
It's all fine. No worries.
No worries.
Yeah.
All right. What else we got?
All right. We got a final question here. Dear doctors, mm-hmm. I've been living with my boyfriend for over 15 years, and I've been with him for a total of 25 years. I'm a young 60. He is 57, but are you ready to fall off your chair? We have never had intercourse. First 10 years, we did some other intimate things, but nothing more. He never pursues or initiates anything with me. I used to try, but I'm tired of being rejected. I want to leave the relationship, but I kind of don't. I definitely need help, but can you give me some insight and some guidance?
Oh, man. I'll let you take this one.
Sure. Just to follow a formula so that everybody can follow the logic, that is that the first place we start is by understanding that all behavior is derived from cost-benefit analysis. So there's a CB that's being run by this lady, and it began, you know, a long time ago. So it began when she was 35 years old. She meets this guy who's 32, and she's sufficiently taken with him that they become an item that is together 25 years later. But he never initiates and never, you know, they never get sexual. This is, you know, pretty amazing. And so, you know, one has to wonder, like, is the guy gay? One has to wonder, or what other sort of odd looking dynamics are going on in this situation. But for one thing is for sure is there's some glue that's holding this together. And it was probably evident fairly early. So there's some kind of great friendship, et cetera. So all cool. She says she wants to leave, but but we know that there must be, you know, if you think of cost benefit as sort of a scale, you know, like a, I don't know, in a, what's one of those, like a scale of justice, you've got like some stuff on one side, then you got some stuff on the other. There's mm-hmm. obviously some stuff on one side that has said, gee, I'd kind of like to maybe have a sexual relationship in my life. And that has crossed her mind for the last 25 years. But at the same time, there's been something weighing down on the other side of the equation that has basically blocked this from happening. So although this is historically interesting, the what's most important now is, what are the cost benefit factors that are in the equation now? And, you know, I usually have some questions that I would poke around real subtly about, trying not to be too direct, but I have to wonder about financial motivations. So I have to wonder, you know, is she dependent on this individual? That's a possibility. And that's one reason, quote, that we would, quote, want to leave, but we can't, or that we won't, or some such thing. It's because maybe there's some, there might be some rather worry about the cold water and the brutal realities of actually having to carve out a living, or a bigger living than she has. So there might be a reduction in standard of living or general financial security, all kinds of things. But let's suppose, for example, that that's not what it is. Let's suppose that this is a really fine friendship and that she's not financially dependent and that she could leave in that arena and not have it be a problem, that he's clearly not sexually interested in her. Why on earth wouldn't we open the relationship up? You know, nobody has to leave this friendship. But why don't we just say, you know what? Why don't we change the rules? You know, I still want to live with you and we're best friends or whatever, but hey, I want to date other people. And, you know, I'm going to plan, if I find somebody I like, I'll sleep with them. And if I fall in love with them, I'm going to leave. But short of that, why not change the rules? I just don't see any reason why we wouldn't. So that's how I look at this. So rather than leaving the relationship, if leaving the relationship for some reason, really for whatever reason, including financial, could be financial, social, could be the friendship itself, it seems it's too big a decision. So it's intimidating this individual into staying. So my attitude is, well, let's make a smaller decision. So there's different ways we could make a smaller decision. So we could obviously leave for 2 months and get our own place and see what that feels like. That's not a bad strategy. But if you're not really that unhappy, but you're just in a warm, supportive friendship, a loving friendship, but there's no sexual chemistry, then by all means, try to piece it together. And see whether or not we can find some adventure and romance, if you're craving that, somewhere else. And I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be something that wouldn't be attempted. And if you happen to run into, I don't know, some strange, funny little psychological characteristics in that partner that he gets all bent out of shape about it, you know, then we've got a very interesting discussion to have. So, but yeah, I would at least poke around in there and see what's there. Jen, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I had exactly the same reaction to that question. You know, with the understanding that I'm filtering that somewhat through my own openness, like that's my natural, mm-hmm. I would just go to like, oh, there's no rules here. You know, and obviously there are some people out, you know, there are lots of people at various points in the bell curve that would just be unthinkable for all kinds of reasons. But there are mm-hmm. 9,000 different ways that you can approach opening it up. You can go to some kind of, you know, have a discussion where you're going to full scale polyamory. You can have a sort of like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas kind of situation where, you know, people are pursuing flings and maybe not even discussing them. Like it depends on what your looking for and what you're missing and what works for your personality and what works for his personality. And so it doesn't have to look like any particular kind of open relationship that you've read about or seen in the movies or anything like that. There are a ton of different ways that you can kind of approach that question and find some kind of arrangement that might work, or at least is worth experimenting with to see if it would work. And yeah, I would say if you broach that subject and he really makes a fuss about it and really can't tolerate the idea of opening up the relationship, that is bizarre. And it makes me wonder what his cost benefit, if he's financially dependent on you. I think that this is just worthy of discussion and basically going into it with all options on the table to find out what kind of situation could possibly be better than the status quo. The idea that it's ever going to change is a complete delusion. Like, he's not going to suddenly get sexually interested after not being sexually interested for 25 years. So we want to just dispatch of that idea, and, you know, focus on how to improve your life circumstances going forward, and his as well. You know, he may have an interest in a different kind of arrangement, and it has just never felt like he's able to discuss it. So no reason not to have that conversation at this point.
Beautiful. That's a good point, Dr. Hawk. So I was gonna ask you what the relevance of his reasons for not having sex, but I think you kind of answered that, saying that it doesn't matter, right? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that relevance?
That relevance meaning what? Like why he's happy to stick around?
Why he doesn't? Yeah, like would it be useful to ask the guy why don't you feel like having sex? You know, I mean, could it?
I mean, I think often people will have that conversation, again, to go back to the previous question, in kind of a manipulative way, trying to get them to change their CB on it. But if they are good friends, and clearly they are, if they've been living together for 25 years and, you know, they've shared a lot of life experiences together, then we would hope that they would have enough capacity in that relationship for crystal clear to, if he has been closeted this whole time, you know, he's now 57, like maybe it's time to confront that and start thinking about other alternatives. But I recognize that people are just not always in a place where they can confront those truths about themselves and certainly have those conversations with other people. And a lot of times that inability and unwillingness to confront those things is what keeps them in these sort of stable, warm friendships that don't have a sexual component. And so there is obviously a decent CB there where everybody is getting some kind of benefit and enjoying the companionship. And there's also no value judgment on that. Like that can be a fine place for two humans to live their life. If that's where these people want to wind up and that works for them, like not everybody needs to have the grand rainbow unicorn angel singing kind of romance in their life. They're perfectly happy with this kind of, you know, stable, cozy, warm situation where there's a really nice esteem dynamic between two humans who enjoy and appreciate each other. So if that's the case, but she is leaking some sadness about her lack of sexuality in her life in this question. And so we want to see if there's a place that we can fit that into the existing dynamic with this otherwise decent human that she enjoys.
All good. Yeah, it's kind
absolutely
of the
brilliant. Well,
just, yeah, this is just, hold on one second. This is just totally redundant, but it's just because it's not anything conceptually different. But the notion is that right now, we're going to call her life a 6 out of 10 with this relationship. Not bad. Okay. Not bad enough. If it was a 4, she would have left a long time ago, but no, it's like not bad. Okay. Now she smells that there's a 10 potential in her nervous system, but not very many people hit that and they don't hit it for very long. So a really good life might be at 80% of your happiness potential. In other words, you know, of a high percentage of the hours that you could reasonably expect it to be very happy, punctuated by a bunch of exquisite moments, that would be just excellent. Okay. She's sniffing that a six is a very conservative game she has played. And mm-hmm. she's feeling the sands of time run out and realize, wait a second, am I never even going to try to hit an eight or a nine ever? And I think it's bugging her, okay,
mm-hmm.
as it should. And so that's why what Jen and I are saying is, hey, let's. There should be enough goodwill in the sound of this thing that it's, you know, if there is, if it's good enough to pull a utterly sexless relationship to a six, not too bad, then it's probably strong enough to withstand the notion of, hey, why don't we see if we can fiddle around with this and see if we can reach some higher numbers?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I love the simplicity of this explanation. It's just something's bugging you, and we just have to figure out what that is. So, yeah. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. Really appreciate the insight in this episode. And
once we got it recording and underway.
Yeah, all good.
That was the first step. Yeah. It's very, very lovely to be here as always.
Very good.
All right.
Thank you, Nathan.
Good
job as always.
We'll speak with you. We'll speak with you next week. Have a good night.
Very good.
Yeah, good night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.